I say this all the time. It ain't what you use, it's the way that you use it. And I really believe it. Mastering is simple. Not easy, but simple. And any modern DAW has more than enough tools to enable you to get great results. But the last few years have seen some genuinely revolutionary new plugins being released. They enable us to change things at the mastering stage that we could only dream about even a few years ago. And some of my favourites are made by Leapwing Audio. Products like Stage 1, which gives you amazing control of the depth and stereo width of your audio with far more control and subtlety than basic mid-side tweaks. Or Dyne 1, which is my favourite tool for applying parallel or upwards compression to get extra fullness, density and richness in the master without squashing the life out of it. There's so much more to these tools, and they're so powerful, I almost need to remind myself, just because I can use them at the mastering stage doesn't necessarily mean that I should. But even being able to try an experiment and offer an example to a client to encourage them to make a mix tweak can be super helpful. And when there isn't the time or the resources for alterations, they are invaluable. You can check out these and all Leapwing's other products now at leapwing.com. It ain't what you use, it's the way that you use it, but sometimes Leapwing is just the thing. Hello, and welcome to The Mastering Show. My name is Ian Shepherd, I'm a mastering engineer, and I run the production advice website, aiming to help you get better results recording, mixing, and mastering your music. So the title of this week's episode is The Emperor's New Ears, and you'll find out what that means in a minute. My guest this week, who actually suggested the topic to me, is the most excellent Ronan Chris Murphy, who is an LA producer, engineer, and you're a mastering engineer as well, right?
I am. I've been doing that for about 10 years now.
Excellent. And I was very lucky to meet Ronan earlier on this year when he invited me over to LA to an event he organized, Audio Bloggers Live. Him, me, Joe Gilder, Graham Cochran, and a bunch of amazing audio names. Give us the guest list, Ronan.
Oh, we had Bob Clearmountain, Mick Gazowski, Dylan Dresdow, John Rod, Brian Lucy, Mayor Applebaum. Yep.
Yeah, it was a fantastic event and such good fun. So, but I've talked about that before actually on the podcast, so I won't get down that tangent. So just quickly for people who maybe haven't come across you before, can you give us the kind of 2-3 minute version of your history, how you became an engineer and what your path was?
Yeah, well, it's a long, windy path, but basically I'm a record producer, engineer, started playing in bands in the sort of early DC punk scene, and then probably by the late 80s, early 90s, kind of ended up on the other side of the glass and have been really focused on making records from that perspective for however long that is, since the early 90s.
What was your instrument? What did you play?
I was, I started, singing, and I kind of do that in air quotes, as I'm sure my mother wouldn't have agreed that was actually singing, but vocals and guitar and things like that. So we were playing in the scene that, punk and what became known as grunge and alternative, playing with like bands like the Flaming Lips and Henry Rollins and All and Descendants, whole bunch of bands like that.
Cool.
And so that was a really exciting sort of scene to get into. But, I stumbled in some downtime into the recording end of things and just kind of fell in love with it and realized maybe I think I was better at making records for other people than trying to be a rock star myself. Mm-hmm. And again, it's been an amazing thing. It's brought me, I've lived in Boston, I lived in Canada, Seattle, England, based in LA now. And yeah, I'd really been doing almost nothing else but really working on music and working on audio all that time. And in terms of being a mastering engineer, it's something about 10 years ago I started getting more and more into, because mostly it took me about 15 years really as a full-time professional engineer until I kind of felt I'd earned it in a way, until I developed my ears to a level where I thought I could master, and I'd accrued enough really good equipment that was right on par with that. And then, back in a bunch of years ago now, I kind of, started what was really like the first recording show with Ronan's Recording Show. And I also have a business called Recording Bootcamp, where we do, intense 6-day workshops in Los Angeles and in Europe. And that was my company that presented Audio Bloggers Live, and we're also doing a thing called the Recording Retreat out in West Virginia, which is a big gathering in the mountains of, you know, fellow audio nerds to sort of learn and kind of share experiences and just geek out in the mountains over recording stuff.
Yeah, I should give you full credit because you were doing the kind of stuff that I'm doing now way before I was. And, you know, it was you doing the recording, Ronan's recording show on YouTube that made me think I should really get into doing YouTube videos, which has been a huge success for my website and the stuff that I'm doing. So
yeah, it's been really exciting to see a lot of people sort of picked up and ran with that. So again, you picked up on it, and Graham Cochran's kind of said the same thing. You know, Pensado's Place came out a year or two after that. So yeah, it's kind of cool. It's just this sort of wacky idea that I had, and I think I was probably the first audio blogger, even though I wouldn't swear to God on that, but it looks that way. And it's really been cool to see like all the big range of just different opinions and personalities sort of come pick up the torch and just bring a whole lot of cool different perspectives out into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And the classes you do, or the courses you do in Europe, I would like to do, because you hire, looks like an Italian villa, yeah?
I do them in a few different places. We do them in Greece and mostly North Italy. But yeah, the one we've got coming up in September, it's a studio built into a 500-year-old North Italian villa. And it's really nice because, we have, lunches with the family that has been living there for hundreds of years, and just amazing food and wine. And yeah, the educational stuff is still there, but... I think the highlight is really the food and the wine.
I was going to say Italy is kind of the perfect place to do that, because I always found the Italians really kind of friendly and welcoming, and it's a beautiful country, and yeah, the food is amazing. On the other hand, I guess all that could be a big distraction to actually getting down to the, shall I go out for another pizza, or should I stick my head inside this kick drum and try and figure out where the mic's going to go?
Yeah, lunch breaks in Italy are a little longer than when we do the courses in Los Angeles.
Yeah. That's cool, but I expect you go on later into the night as well to make up for it.
Yeah, we go out to dinner and drinking wine late into the night. Yes.
Very cool. And something you didn't mention just now that you told me when we were talking just before we started recording that I wasn't aware of is that, because you've suggested the topic, maybe we should talk a little bit about the topic. So the title of it is The Emperor's New Ears, and of course that's a play on The Emperor's New Clothes, which is the famous story of, the guys who sold the vain emperor a set of invisible clothes that you had to be very intelligent to be able to see.
Yes.
And that kind of relates to this thing that happens in audio where it almost seems to me like you can claim to be able to hear anything.
Yes.
And then disparage anybody else if they can't, so you could kind of walk into a room and say, oh, what's that strange tone? And everybody else kind of looks around confused. And there may or may not be a strange tone that you can hear, but I feel like there's almost a reluctance amongst people to kind of be straightforward and honest about what they can and they can't hear, which, vexes me. Coming from my kind of scientific background, if there's something that I can and can't or can't hear or think that I can hear, I want to know whether I can hear it or not, because I'm aware that I've been fooled in the past, and I'm convinced that other people are being fooled by certain things. And it kind of relates to last week's topic with the high sample rates. So
yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a great topic. And you were saying that you're actually kind of pretty well qualified to discuss it because you have some qualifications in a related field. Is that right?
Yeah, actually. Before I really started making my living making records for people, my training is actually in psychology and a Bachelor of Science with a emphasis on quantitative analysis. So, this whole thing of, what I refer to as expectation bias, other ways to phrase it as well, but it's amazing how just massive and real it is. And when you look at this expectation bias, again, the short of you will hear or you will taste or you will feel what you think you are going to feel is just an insanely real thing. So it's not something where somebody is an idiot if they, think they heard something, but they didn't. It's just how we are wired as human beings. And virtually anybody who says they're immune to that is just either not the same species that you and I are, or
getting themselves kinda, delusional.
Yeah, exactly. Or delusional or things like that. So
let's give some simple ideas. Just so that people know exactly what we're talking about. Everybody's done it, right? It's the thing where you spend 10 minutes just tweaking the EQ on a channel until you think it's absolutely perfect, and then realize that the whole thing was bypassed, right? Or it's the other famous example I know of is the DFA switch. Do you have that in the US?
I'm not sure the name, but I'm sure I know what you're talking about.
it's the DFA switch. It does all.
Yeah, we call it the producer switch.
There you go. Yeah, it's the magic button that you when the client is just, I need something, you go, okay, here, listen to this, and you flick a switch that does absolutely nothing, and they go, yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. Their expectation that something is going to happen because you flicked a switch. Or our expectation that something is happening when we tweak the EQ channel settings on a channel that actually is bypassed, we think we're hearing stuff and we're not. That's basically the effect that we're talking about. And I have a kind of a fairly long-winded example of a time when that caught me out pretty badly. Yeah. How about you? I mean, anything spring to mind for you?
I do. I mean, the thing for me, unfortunately, is I've proved this... actually in front of audiences, because I do lectures and stuff around the world, and being in front of something, with an EQ, flipping it in and out, going, okay, this is going to be subtle, but what I want you to listen to is, subtly how the stereo spread is getting a little bit wider and we're getting a little more definition in that voice, click, 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 click. Of course, half the audience is nodding, they hear it. And then there's a couple people kind of tilting their heads sideways. And of course I realize, it wasn't even patched in. And I'm like, okay, on to our next discussion. But that's the thing. I mean, this is what I do every day. And I do this audio work at a pretty high level that people pay good money for. And again, even somebody who does this in and out is well-regarded will make this mistake. So it's really important to, just like anything else, it's a physical thing that happens or a mental thing that happens to us. So it's not something, it's always embarrassing, but not something that somebody is a lesser human if they've fallen victim to it. But tell me about yours. I'm all excited about it now.
Well, I hope you won't feel let down. It's just this particular example that kind of stands out in my mind. It's one of my favorite ever mastering jobs. I was just really, I spend quite a lot of time working on music that, I kind of like, and I spend quite a lot of time working on music that I hate, and I spend a small amount of time working on music that I really like, something where the finished CD, you might actually take it home, put it in your collection and listen to it, and this was one of those projects. And I was just absolutely delighted with the result that we got. It was kind of slightly electronica, kind of poppy, trip hoppy, breathy female vocals, really well produced, great songwriting, I just loved it. So the whole project was a huge pleasure. And then about a month after I had done the mastering session, I got a call from the customer saying, I'm really concerned because the pressed CDs just don't sound as good as the test disc, right? This is something that had kept coming up at that time. It was, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And the kind of the topic of CD differences, people saying that stuff that was data identical in some way sounded different. Yeah. And my immediate reaction was to say to the client, look, that can't happen. I immediately went off and did a bit for bit comparison of what I had on the computer and the safety copy of the disc that I had on file and the pressed copy that he sent me. And the numbers were the same. And if the numbers are the same and you're playing it back on the same machine, there is no good reason why it should sound different. Mm-hmm. But being the scientist that I am, and because he was so, the more I said to him, I really think you're imagining things effectively. I found a more tactful way of putting it, but the more upset he got, understandably, because he was convinced he'd heard this effect. And so the next thing I did was I stuck the disc on to listen, because I thought, well, I can't completely rule it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as an example, one of the theories at the time was that to take an extreme example, let's say you took a CD and you taped a coin to one side of it, so that when you put it in the machine and it spins up, there's actually a significant vibration of the disc in the machine. Yeah, it's wobbling up and down.
Yeah.
If that happens, it's going to make it much harder for the laser to track the spiral of pits and grooves on the disc. Mm-hmm. That's going to either cause errors, which could affect the integrity of the audio stream, or it's going to cause the motor to work much harder, trying to stabilize the disc and possibly cause speed variations. And if there's any kind of imperfect circuit design in the player, you can imagine a situation where the motor noise might influence the sound of the signal. In fact, my first ever CD player had exactly that effect. If you listened on the built-in headphone jack, rather than through the phono outputs, when the disc was spinning up, you could hear motor noise on the headphones. You know, you could actually hear this kind of whine and then this kind of thing as it kind of settled into its... So anyway, so I could imagine that this guy wasn't delusional. And I felt... So, you know, I went in full of skepticism, put the discs in, played them, and I thought, oh my God, he's right. It's clear as day. I can hear exactly what he's talking about. The test copy sounds more open. It sounds more sweet and warm. I was baffled. I'd done the comparison. So then I ran error check analyses on the disc to see whether maybe the error rate on the press disc was really high or something else. I couldn't find any good reason. And then, you know, I've been fooled before. So the alarm bells started ringing. And long story short, I spent 6 hours working with a colleague of mine. We had two identical CD players rigged up into parallel channels on an analog desk. We level matched them to less than half a dB of accuracy using test tones. And then I was sitting facing one end of the room. He swapped the inputs behind me, would randomly play me one or the other with no kind of, you know, he wouldn't even speak to me because we didn't want to have, you know, when you're testing these things, you have to be so careful. And we might dig into that later on in the episode.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't even say anything to me. It would just be like, okay, this is A, this is B. And I would say which one, I would pick the one that I thought sounded better. And I went through this and I did 40 trials. It took 2 or 3 hours. And I mean, poor Simon must have been going out of his mind with boredom. So I kind of tallied it up and said, okay, how did I do? And he was like, okay, you're 70-30. And I was like, what? That means a significant amount of the time over the number of trials that I did, I had noticed a difference. I was able to hear. So suddenly I had a real example of CD differences in front of me. Went away and had some lunch, and I was kind of thinking, have I missed it? And then suddenly it occurred to me that the whole time we'd been doing it, he'd had one disc in one CD player and one disc in the other CD player. So just to be sure, I got him to swap them over, and we did another 40 trials, another 2 or 3 hours of testing in the afternoon. And we got to the end, and I said, how did I do? And he said, same, 70-30, roughly. And I was like, well, that's it then. This is real. We have to figure out what's wrong with the press discs. And he said, no, it switched. You identified them the other way round. which means that I was 70-30% able to identify which CD player I was listening to, not which CD I was listening to, right? And suddenly, okay, there it is. Whatever I was hearing, it was not a difference between the data on the CDs. I mean, I'm assuming it was a fractional level difference between the two signal paths. Or, you know, I mean, it was a really nice Studer desk that we ran it through, but even there could have been manufacturing tolerances players.
And good ears, quarter dB of difference we can hear.
Exactly, yeah. You can hear frighteningly small differences in level, or you can perceive some kind of difference. So that was my journey down the rabbit hole, in the sense that I was utterly convinced going in, and that was my expectation bias, right? If I hadn't remembered to do that swap of the CDs, if I hadn't realized that I needed to do that to be completely scientific, that because otherwise the test wasn't truly random. Again, we can come back to that in a little while. Yeah, I would have believed in CD differences, and who knows where I'd have gone from there. And that to me just kind of stands out in my mind as what you said before. You know, I don't think anybody should feel remotely embarrassed by being fooled by any of this stuff at any point. I mean, a good friend whose opinion I respect recently told me that he went to a trial of, have you heard of the, I can't remember the brand name. There's somebody selling really high specification power cables.
Yes, I think I know the gentleman you're talking to.
The idea is that one of them will give you better quality mains power for your gear and improve the sound. And that doesn't sound crazy when you think about it, except that the test that was described to me was that they had two, I think they were 192 Pro Tools converters, right? One of them powered by a normal mains cable and one of them powered by a different kind of mains cable. Now, And the guy I was talking to was convinced he was hearing a significant difference, even though the levels had been very precisely matched and all the rest of it. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of that trial. I don't know whether he was blind testing or whether he was... Because if he wasn't blind testing, I guess that's one thing to say about all of these kind of trials. One of the things that can happen is you can just be influenced by an opinion. You know, in the thing that I just described in my test, I was fooled by an actual difference, and my expectation bias was to put the reason for that difference in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's one thing. But another thing is just if somebody's saying to you, okay, listen to this, and now listen to this, that can introduce an expectation bias.
Absolutely. We can dive into it a little bit later, but it's one of the reasons why, you know, when I do work here, we do a lot of blind testing here with, you know, almost any piece of equipment that we're truly trying to evaluate, whether it's for me reviewing for a video or something I might spend a few $1,000s on. We do actually double blind testing, which is actually super important. What you're beginning to describe, but you know, we as humans are just amazing at picking up emotion from other human beings. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, if I say, oh, here's some Behringer mic, and now, you know, right up against this, you know, $10,000 Neumann, and, you know, go back and forth, even matched, you know, the listener doesn't know what they're hearing, and they all of a sudden pick the Behringer one, even if I'm trying to keep a straight face, my eyebrow might go up or, you know, twinkle in my eye a little bit. And they've found, you know, quantitatively that people will actually change their opinion. So if the person saying, listen to A, now listen to B, knows which is which, it will quantifiably shift results of A-B comparisons. Mm.
Yeah. So effectively, these kind of really subtle, kind of unintentional clues being given by the person offering up the test are polluting the data by influencing the person who's doing the test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can tell when a good friend is upset, even when they show up and say, no, everything's great. You know, we can tell there's, you know, nonverbal clues that give us a sense that somebody's happy or upset or surprised and things like that. So when we're doing testing here, you know, hardware versus plug-in or plug-in versus plug-in or comparing two mics, we've actually developed a system where it's almost always double-blind testing.
So can you describe that practically, or is it kind of complicated?
Well, there's a few different ways depending on microphones versus plugins. But one of the things we'll do actually is, depending on the signal flow, we'll actually swap and twist cables. Like when we're comparing microphones to one another, we'll actually swap the cables on the output of the mic pre and spin them around a whole bunch of times, identical cables, and plug them back in. And that way, neither person in the room knows which one got plugged into A, which one got plugged into B. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times too, when we're really doing critical stuff, you know, we'll actually go in and relabel tracks and then shuffle them, and then maybe even have the other person relabel tracks and shuffle them just to really be sure. Cause especially at a level when, you know, we're doing these things, you know, one, it's just good to know as a geek, but also, you know, guys like yourself and myself, you know, our opinions one way or the other on a piece of software, a piece of gear, can actually have pretty big influences on people. So if I'm saying, yes, I believe this is better, or no, it's not better, where that might actually make the difference in tens of thousands of dollars of sales to a small company or something, you know, I want to make sure that I'm really, really, really accurate and not just sort of, you know, talking my biases or the biases of a collaborator.
Absolutely. Well, and you don't want to waste people's time. You know, there's no point in spending, you know, kind of half an hour trying to figure out whether to use in-the-box summing versus a hardware summing unit when actually you've previously proved to yourself that you can't hear the difference between them. You know, that's just, it's a waste of time and effort. It's interesting you mentioned the twisted cable, because that's reminded me of something that I developed. You know, double blind testing is kind of easier with more than one person involved in the trial, right? Because you, like you described, you can get it so that the person who knows isn't able to convey to the person who doesn't know in any way what the situation is. I came up with this thing that I call the three-fingered mouse click. this was when I was testing whether or not I could hear the difference of dithered versus truncated audio. Again, resisting the temptation to get into a dither tangent, anybody who actually wants to know about dither, it must be in such a fit of suspense by now. It's been mentioned so many times. Anyway, there will be a dither episode at some point. Basically, it just means, you know, you have a toggle switch. You can, if you click your finger fast enough, you can end up so that you don't really know which one is on or off. But I discovered that actually I was getting too accurate on stuff And that somehow I was subconsciously, I was aware of how many times I'd clicked it. So I started using two fingers, kind of double tapping on the, and I figured even then I could still kind of mentally keep track. It's almost like when you spin a coin, I sometimes think you can kind of feel how many times it's flipped around, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I started using three fingers, two fingers on one hand and one on the other, kind of randomly tapping at the mouse. Yes, with my eyes closed so that I don't know whether this thing is on or off. And then I start clicking on and off. It's quite a useful strategy. The problem with it is, well, one thing about it is it makes you very aware of expectation bias.
Yes.
Because the number of times I've done that, finished, sat there, clicked and clicked and clicked and go, okay, so that's A, because it sounds so much better than B. Mm-hmm. And then realized that during the three-fingered mouse clicking, I just moved the mouse off the thing that I was toggling on and off.
Yes.
And the whole time I'd been testing it on and off, I wasn't doing anything. I was just clicking in a little bit of blank screen.
God, I wish I could laugh at you for that. And I do that when I do that again, that toggle, like closing your eyes, turning your head away, toggling back and forth, you know, if I'm just doing it alone, you know, I'll do kind of 1, 2, 7, 3, 9, 7, you know, Spice Girls, Metallica, Slayer, you know, just trying to get my mind thinking on all sorts of different things and then back to it. But one thing too, is if you actually print things to track, especially in print things to track and then level match, you know, one thing too, is also if you've got a buddy or got a spouse who maybe even doesn't know anything about, you know, working with audio, it doesn't take long to teach them how to relabel something and shuffle the order of a track. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go make a sandwich, you know, have your buddy come in and, you know, relabel things and shuffle them around and then come back. That's pretty darn blind.
Yeah, that works. And there's even an automated way of doing that. If people Google around a bit, you can find ABX testing applications. Mm-hmm. So for anybody who doesn't know, ABX is kind of a step beyond the AB test. You know, A-B testing is where you have two things, you don't know what they are, and you try and figure out whether you can hear a difference. ABX is where you have A and you have B, and you know that they are different, but then you have X, and you have to figure out, is it the same as A or is it the same as B?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in practical terms, you have a utility. What's the one that I use on the Mac called? I think it's called ABXer. Mm-hmm. And it's free. It's a bit nuts and bolts, but it works. So, you know, you choose, you tell it, okay, this is file A, this is file B, and it's okay for you to know what those are. And then you say, run a test, and it will allow you to listen to A and then B and then X. Mm-hmm. And you choose which once you've spent enough time and figured out what you think is what, you choose is X A, is X B. Then you move on and you do 10 trials. And then at the end of it, that it tells you how you scored. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about it is it even tells you, I think we won't bother to get into the statistics of it, but basically out of 10 trials, you need to hear something 9 times out of 10 to be absolutely, well, not even absolutely certain, but to be pretty confident. If you do that, there's a very low probability that you did it by chance. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 feels convincing to us, but over 10 trials, you have a pretty good chance of doing that by random.
Yeah. Just like your almost like your results with the CD players.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's the other. Well, if I hadn't kind of done 40 trials of each, then I wouldn't have believed my 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the just quickly referring back to last week's episode where we were talking about, you know, this new study of people being able to hear the difference of high sample frequencies versus normal sample rates. The power of that meta study was combining all of those different tests so that they had a much bigger pool of data. You know, so I had 80 trials altogether in my little test that I did. They had, I think they narrowed down 12,000 trials to, I think it might only have been 400 or maybe it was 4,000. Anyway, a much smaller set, but you know, even so, it's a very large number of samples. So you can really rely on the results of those tests. Mm-hmm. So yeah, people could play with ABX testing if they would like.
Yeah. And one thing I kind of want to mention for people who might be listening to this is, again, getting into this sort of minutia and absolute testing it's something important for guys like you and I who are mastering for people. I mean, one of the things they pay us is for us to have done the research and have formed strong opinions. And we're also, you know, educators. Mm-hmm. A lot of this in terms of, you know, is this plugin better than this plugin? You know, those are good things to know. And especially if you're going to drop a whole bunch of money on something or invest in a company. But if you pull up an EQ or compressor plugin or piece of hardware and go, I love the way that sounds. Great. Let's move on to the next thing. Mm. But it's kind of crazy when you start getting into these differences, which I'm happy there are people in the world kind of going crazy and obsessing about these. But it's interesting when you get into these issues, man, follow an internet thread about Meridian Dither Type 1 versus Meridian Dither Type 2 or something. And, you know, you get in these bloodbaths. And I always kind of say with people, you know, it's part of like a lecture I do. It's my part of my 6-day thing where we're talking about where the big differences happen in the recording chain. You know, you'll see guys on the internet going, oh my God, this converter is terrible. It's unusable. Or, oh my God, if you can't hear the difference between, you know, 44.1 and 48, you're an idiot, blah, blah, blah. Okay, all valid. But I'd say take any of those people and say, okay, I've got a deal for you. You can do it in your studio, speakers you know perfectly. I'm going to give you 5 files that were processed using the 2 different methods. If you can get 4 out of 5 correct, I'll give you $5,000. If you get less than that, you give me your house. Not a single person would take that bet. Not a single person. You know, again, talking about like high sample rates, which I don't want to dismiss in any way, shape, or form. There are differences. But again, when people get into this and start looking at it like from this crazy religious war perspective, you know, you really have to understand it's like, okay, if X converter is absolutely unusable, the difference must be so massive to your preference here that we're going to do this test. I give you $5,000 or you give me your house. Nobody would take that bet.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of maybe people just learning this stuff on their own or with, you know, less time in the trenches, they'll sort of read this stuff on the internet and go, can I make music with the Aurora converter? Because a guy on the internet said that one's bad and this other one is good. And
yeah.
Yeah. Just understand that so much of that is sort of just stupid religious debate.
And I would say that moving the mic a couple of inches is probably going to have a bigger effect.
Hands down. I mean, not even probably, 100% guaranteed. That the difference of moving a microphone 1 inch on a speaker cabinet is a far bigger difference than the difference of any 2 converters on the market right now.
Yeah.
And I would take that bet. If somebody moved a microphone on a guitar amp, you know, 1 inch out from the center of the cone out to the edge, I would take that $5,000 versus my house bet. Well, easy. I rent my house, so. But that's the kind of thing. It's those differences are massive. The differences of changing out a guitar pick are massive. You know, neck pickup to bridge pickup on a Les Paul are massive. And when we get into these differences about high sample rate or X converter or even hardware versus, you know, plug-in kind of things, you know, those are just, I don't want to dismiss any of those things because every step of the process is important and should be cared about. But a lot of people kind of get crazy and focus on the wrong end.
You need to keep it in perspective, don't you? Flavors of Dither is another example. The hardware versus software. You know, there are subtle differences, and sometimes some people will hear them on some material. But the fact is, whatever it is you have, you're going to use, and you're going to make it sound the way that you like. You know, I do not believe, I mean, I haven't done these tests myself rigorously, but my instinct is that if I was comparing, you know, a Universal Audio emulation of an 1176 versus an actual 1176, I certainly don't think they would sound the same. But I think I could use either of them to get a sound I was equally happy with.
You know,
and I've done similar stuff in the past. Just picking up quickly on something moving the mic is an interesting one. Something to mention to people is you have to be very careful about moving your head when you're doing these kind of tests. I suspect that the reason my client from those where he thought the CD sounded different, well, there's lots of interesting things here. One is that simple things are easier to compare than complicated things. And that music was very complicated, texturally, tonally, harmonically, everything. So the fact is our attention span is pretty short. And if you just happen to focus on, you know, this bit of a vocal phrase versus that bit, you're going to hear differences. That if you're convinced they're down to the difference of a CD versus another CD, you might misattribute. And the same thing is true, you know, if you move your head, that you know, it completely changes the frequency response. If you have a testing mic and you run a frequency scan in a room, any room, and then you move it an inch to the left, you will get something that looks different and probably sounds different as well. The phase relationships change, the, you know, all kinds of subtle things change. If you want to try playing with an ABX tester application, make sure you don't move your head too much because that will skew your opinion as well. One thing I was going to mention, I mean, again, I think the theme, what I would really like people to take away from this is, I mean, on the one hand, be open to the idea that, you know, well, Russell had a great example last week when he was talking about a busted microphone that he had, and his clients immediately picked up on this strange noise. And he was explaining that it was the whole kind of thing of miscommunication. They were describing it as a buzz. And what he eventually figured out was it was a tiny, high-pitched tone because this mic had been damaged. And he'd been focusing his attention in a completely different part of the audio frequency looking for a buzz and just couldn't hear what they were. And then when he realized it was a tone, suddenly he was like, oh, you mean that? And then he could hear it.
Yep.
So it is important to be open if you or somebody else thinks they're hearing something. Just because everybody else can't hear the thing that you can hear doesn't mean it's not there.
Yep.
On the other hand, just because somebody is emphatically telling you they can hear something that you can't hear doesn't mean that it's real and that you're in some way, you know, the emperor or the, who is it in the story, who, you know, the guy who can't see the clothes because he's stupid, you know.
Exactly.
I think people should have confidence. And one of the reasons for that is to do with this thing called the placebo effect, which is related to confirmation or expectation bias, but subtly different. And I think probably the example I like to give is a medical trial. I mean, everybody kind of, I think, has an idea of the whole thing of placebo testing. When you're testing a new drug, you have to do a blind test, as we've been describing, because, you know, this could be a matter of life and death. So it's critical that the scientists get this stuff right. So they always have a placebo where people think they're being given this new treatment that's being tested, and actually they're just being given something that does nothing.
Sugar pills,
sugar pills or whatever. But the findings of that are really counterintuitive. What they have discovered is that if you give somebody two different types of paracetamol, painkiller, the one that's in the fancy packaging and that costs more actually genuinely reduces pain more than the cheap, nasty packaged paracetamol, even though it's exactly the same pill, right? It actually has a real world. So, you know, and this is, people are talking about pain relief, right? It's not, well, I guess you could argue.
Which is a subjective assessment,
It's a subjective assessment, but the fact is it works. And my translation of that is that if you spend $1,000 a meter on speaker cable because you think it's going to make it sound better, and you compare it to, I mean, the famous trial is where they compared, I think it was Monster Cable with a coat hanger.
Yes.
and it was shown that nobody could hear the difference when they couldn't tell which they were listening to, right? When it was blind. And that's why blind testing is so important. When they did know the difference between what they were listening to, not only did they hear that the more expensive cable sounded better, but that's a real effect. You know, I mean, it genuinely sounds better to the person listening because of the placebo effect, because of this confirmation bias effect. So again, it's a kind of real psychological effect that, you know, just means people shouldn't feel bad if they get affected by it. And I think it's why people get so upset in the, you know, in the online debates about this stuff, because if you say, I hear this thing, this sounds better, and then somebody says, but there's no reason why that should be the case, you know, there's no benefit to super expensive speaker cable versus mains cable, it feels like they're saying to you, you didn't hear what you just did. You were fooling yourself. And that's not the case. You really did hear that it sounded better. It's just that the reason wasn't because, in objective physics terms, the cable was better. It was for the same reason that expensive painkillers work better than cheap painkillers, even when it's the same active ingredient. It's because you're human and you believe that it's going to sound better, and it really does sound better to you.
Well, it's also one of the things when I'm kind of doing lectures about like finding the right vocal mic and things like that. You know, if you've been working with some horrible Behringer mic for the last few years and you finally saved up enough money to buy that thing with a Neumann logo on it, and you're all excited, you know, saved up for 2 years, you're absolutely 100% sure it's going to sound better, and it will sound better to you. But, you know, there is the odd chance that just with the character of those different mics, that maybe the cheap mic actually sounds better on your voice. So it's one of those things where I always try and tell people, like, set up these blind tests, because you don't want to go and blow $2,000 when the piece of gear you already own might actually be the better tool. And, you know, you can save yourself a lot of money that you can use for other more exciting things.
And we should probably say, because I grew up with the BBC where they compulsively say other brands are available. You know, we've mentioned kind of Behringer slightly disparagingly a couple of times this evening. But the truth is, people I respect have told me there are various bits of Behringer gear that actually they're pretty damn good.
I use their cable tester.
There you go. I mean, you know, it's, and yeah, there's almost certainly other stuff. And it's a kind of a classic example. I mean, the same thing is true of me in my little home mastering studio. No, I still have my B&W, the hi-fi speakers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not cheap, but they're not super expensive. I would like to upgrade them at some point. I'm going to have to get a serious bang for my buck to spend, you know, kind of £5,000 as opposed to £500 in order to get my money's worth, basically. Yep. So I'm going to be doing some serious testing when the time comes for that.
Yeah. Oh, one thing actually back to, you know, I don't know that we're talking about the same guy, but there's a company that makes the very, you know, high-end boutique-y electrical cables. And again, one of those companies had approached me, and especially early on when Ronan's Recording Show was like the game in town, a lot of people were trying to, you know, get me to review stuff. And I said, man, this is a great idea. I would love to do it. And I kind of explained that I was going to set up a bunch of level match, double blind tests, you know, where we could really do, you know, objective comparisons. And it was amazing. The more and more I kept describing it, you know, you could almost just see the guy like sneaking back, like, yeah, this isn't really something that we need in our life right now.
It's, yeah. That, and that's, well, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, so I'm fascinated by, lots of people know about Mixer Man. And he's written, you know, a bunch of great books about engineering and producing and recording. And one of his kind of bugbears is the whole thing of analog summing versus digital summing.
Mm-hmm.
I've not done the test myself, but if I was going to test analog versus digital summing, I would want to level match for a start. You know, I mean, if it's an analog unit, there are going to be tiny little gain differences between a channel. So if I've got a digital mixer versus an analog one, I would want to individually level test all of those channels and then make sure that I loudness matched the output of the digital system with the analog one before I did my comparisons. Mm-hmm. And then I would use an ABX trial. And I know people who've done this test and they say on the systems that they've tested where the summing unit, the kind of idea of it is to be very clean, there's, you know, you can't hear a difference. There are other analog summing systems where the idea is definitely not to be clean and there you probably can hear a difference.
Yeah.
He just says that entire testing paradigm is he won't have it because his feeling is it's about the way this stuff makes you work. What he says is try mixing something, start off digital and then plug in the summing unit at the point where you get stuck, you know, at the point where you're kind of going around in circles and feeling like the mix isn't going anywhere. That's where you patch in the analogs. And he says from then on, everything will go easier. It'll all just fall into place. It'll just happen that much quicker. It may not even sound any better, but he says he gets there faster using the analog summing than the digital summing. And that's kind of fascinating because the way that he's telling you to do the test makes it impossible to be objective, right?
Uh-huh.
Because at the point where you swap it out and start doing more work, suddenly you can't do a fair comparison between before and after. And even because, you know, my feeling is I would love to test him. The scientific bit of me would like to say, okay, we're going to do what you're saying. And at the point where you say, okay, now's the time to patch it in, we may or may not put in an analog summing unit. And then you've got to tell us whether or not we've done it by how easy it is for you to complete the mix and see. And who knows? He might be completely accurate. He might be right. But until you do that test, his test is a non-test.
Yeah.
And this is something that I see. You know, I'm not saying he's wrong and I'm not saying that he's his opinion. That's based on a lot of experience and he feels very passionately about it. And he might be right.
Yeah.
But and I'm not suggesting he's deliberately designed a test that kind of can't prove or disprove what he's suggesting. That's just his feeling about the way that it should be done. But it just kind of highlights how difficult it is to set up a fair test and
I think it's really important, though, that people really start to differentiate, you know, obvious biases about subjective experience and qualitative back and forth, where, again, if he says, you know, he finds it easier to mix, well, then that's true. I mean, assuming we don't know each other well or anything, but that's sort of true. It's same sort of thing as I've got this Thelonious Monk t-shirt I love. And if I said, you know, days I come in wearing my Thelonious Monk t-shirt, I just master better. I mean, that is a, you know, subjectively true experience to me. If I said that when I wear my Thelonious Monk t-shirt, you know, my Crane Song converters are more linear. Okay. Then we need to, okay, that's a very different thing. And that's, I think, where a lot of people kind of get screwed up. I mean, and to me personally, like I year and a half now, I got rid of the analog console, but I can mix faster on an analog console. I enjoy the experience of mixing on an analog console. I did my first mix in the box in 1993, so it's not like some scary thing that I don't know how to do well. But all those things of like, oh, I enjoy that. I'm less tired. I feel I can be more creative. All those things are like objective and awesome and great. You know, and I meet people like, you know, who have preferences like, oh, that mic, I love it. It's just it's the best mic. I don't care if it was X dollars. And I think, oh my God, I used that mic and thought the manufacturer should be brought up on war crimes for putting it into the market. But it doesn't make their experience not true or not accurate or not honest. If they love that microphone, there's microphones that cost $100 that I love more than a lot of microphones that cost $4,000 or $5,000. And so that's the big thing that I think is really important. And, you know, guys like you and I who've sort of been in the online world and of audio for quite a while, you sort of see it. People start getting wrapped up in, and they really blur the lines of, this was my subjective experience of being involved with this, and mixing that up to, here's an empirical thing where other experiences are not valid or not true.
Yeah, that's something that really bugs me, is somebody expresses an opinion as fact. You know, they kind of, it's like the kind of whole, you know, oh, vinyl just wipes the floor with digital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no question vinyl and digital are different.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're expressing is a preference.
Yes.
And they say it as though it's a fact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people say things as fact, yeah, no, I completely agree. And that leads me onto the final point I was going to make, which leads into the maxim this week, the mastering maxim.
I hope you're not talking about the Avid plugin.
No.
Which is objectively a bad limiter.
Oh, I haven't used it, so I couldn't possibly comment. I'll take your word for it.
Sarcasm.
There's a name for this effect, and I can't remember what it was. I had a quick Google. I couldn't find it. Maybe somebody will know and tell us in the comments this week. When somebody expresses an opinion one way or another, like analog summing versus digital summing, or expensive mic versus cheap mic, or converter X versus converter Y, there is a human tendency, once you've come out in public and said something, to stick by that opinion. And the more you get argued with, the tighter you grab it and won't let go, even in the face of all evidence. And, you know, I mean, so the jury is still out on the what causes the difference between high and normal sample rates. But the people who believe that it's because there are extra high frequencies there and that those are somehow important, you know, really that's a very tenuous theoretical point of view to have, because all the evidence is we can't hear super high frequencies. So you find people coming up with more and more outlandish. Well, I mean, some of them are not outlandish. You know, one of the theories is maybe we're sensing conduction of sound through the bones of the skull rather than through the inner ear. You know, that's something that needs to be tested and investigated. It comes up with the analog versus digital. People start saying, oh, there's something in the science that we just don't understand yet. You know, just because we don't have a good scientific explanation for why analog is better than digital doesn't mean it's not true. And that's because we somehow don't understand the science. And as I said in the episode earlier on about analog versus digital, actually what they're missing is at the end of the day, we're talking about the movement of electrons in a wire. Mm-hmm. You know, not our perception of sound in a room is one thing. There's a whole load of stuff we don't understand there. But in terms of the movement of electrons in a wire, that's something we understand really, really well. You know, the physics of that is basically nailed. And so there's not really any room for anybody to kind of come up with some other explanation. But even so, people who've come out and said, I think analog is categorically better than digital, you know, will argue it, even though really they have no scientific leg to stand on. That leads me into the maxim. Because the maxim this week is, do be open-minded. You know, try not to let that happen to you. Just because you said last week that this plugin was better than that plugin, allow yourself to have your opinion changed. You know, be scientific about it. I can't remember who said it. Somebody said that science is the art of highly nuanced doubt. Meaning, you know, science basically says we don't know anything. Anything is possible. All we know is, we can say this, we can say this, we can say this, and we can say this, and we can draw a conclusion from it. And there's always the possibility that something else will come in. You know, I mean, a year or two ago, somebody thought that neutrinos could travel faster than the speed of light. Mm-hmm. That came out of the CERN. If that had turned out to be true, it would have turned the fabric of science on its head. It turned out it was because of a dodgy connection in a cable somewhere, and they were able to track it down. But in the space between the results being published and them finding out what caused the problem, all of those scientists were being very open-minded about the possibilities. And we need to do the same in our own little way with audio. You know, don't start calling somebody an idiot because they happen to disagree with you about controversial issue X, Y, and Z. On the other hand, I think, like you said earlier, people need to be realistic. You know, they need to be sensible.
It's such a boring waste to get entrenched. I mean, there's certain people where the experience of making music sort of ties to like virtually religious traditions about, oh, this is how it's done. I only use tape. And it's like, okay, that's fine. They're kind of enjoying being part of that that ritual. And I think there's certain validity to that. But when we start thinking about, oh, the sounds we can use, or X converter versus Y converter, or hardware versus plugin, it just seems such a boring waste to get entrenched, because, you know, there's so many new possibilities. And, you know, of course I have sort of fun, you know, bashing on a few things, and there are a few things too, where, you know, I've been a long loudmouth about digital amp modelers for guitars. Mm-hmm. And my reason for that is not religious. It's just that, you know, after a decade of mixing records, when they come in with these digital amp modelers, my job is much harder. I find it much more difficult to get them to blend and sit where, you know, I traditionally want them to go. But, and that's not because, you know, a little glowy thing is religious to me. It's sort of, if something shows up and it's like, wow, this is a great guitar sound. Well, if it's done with an amp model, I think, well, this is awesome. Great. They're getting better at it. And, you know, and there are times where, you know, I've, you know, even checked something, like pull up a mix and go, wow, this sound is amazing. You know, what a killer synth sound. They're like, oh yeah, that's my iPhone. And it's like, you know, and last week I had, you know, my entire studio was filled with amazing analog synths and getting some killer sounds. But yeah, if somebody goes, oh, here's a killer thing from an iPhone, it's like, man, this is awesome. The palette just expanded. The ways I can create and make art just expanded. You know, maybe save money, all those kind of good things. So yeah, that's the thing. When I have very little interest in people who sort of get entrenched about these audio issues one way or the other. And
I completely agree. And I have a couple of those examples myself. I have tested myself in the past and convinced myself that I can hear the difference between 24-bit truncated down to 16-bit audio and dithered audio, not just kind of listening to reverb tiles and all the rest of it, but when the music is playing and all the rest of it. And there are an awful lot of people who tell me that I'm insane for thinking that. Mm-hmm. Now, since recent conversations with people telling that I've been insane, I've been trying to find a really good example so that I can hear it really clearly on, to offer to them so that they can test themselves. Because mm-hmm. I think, you know, like everything else, you hear these things more on some material than on others, and on some systems than others, and all the rest of it. But I have to try and be open to the fact that I might be wrong. You know, I might have got lucky with my trials back then. I know for a fact I didn't get 9 out of 10 trials right. Uh-huh. It almost certainly wasn't statistically significant back then. Yeah. Same thing applies to loudness. You know, I mean, I'm going on about loudness the whole time, and I mean, this one I'm pretty much not open to the idea that I'm wrong about the fact that going beyond a certain loudness is always detrimental. Mm-hmm. But there are definitely examples of records that are louder than I would suggest that they would be that still sound fantastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I have to be honest about the fact that, you know, it's not like loudness always kills stuff dead, you know, or that distortion is always bad, or that clipping is always bad, or any of these mm-hmm. things. And so, yeah, those are kind of a couple of examples from where I've got my entrenched opinion, but it's, you know, we need to keep that kind of that nuanced doubt.
Yeah. The one thing I will throw out is sort of the contrarian old man comment too, is especially for maybe the people with lesser experience getting into this. One thing though about all of this too is, don't completely discount the opinion of people who've done this a lot more than you have. Because a lot of that too is like, oh, this mic versus this mic is something, oh my God, I use this, you know, say inexpensive condenser mic, and oh, it blew away the whatever, the other one that the pros say is the awesome one. Well, part of that might be, okay, you subjectively enjoyed that, but maybe the pros, having maybe mixed a few hundred more records than you, know that, oh, these characteristics in tracking that you were drawn to are actually going to create problems in mixing. You know, once we apply the processing that's very typical of a modern style production, or man, it's stupid, I didn't hear a difference, and one of those is $2,000 more. Never rule out that maybe your ears aren't developed yet, which is really common. Just think of any field that you don't have expertise in, you know, whether it's, you know, oil painting or cooking or photography or something, where, you know, the fact that you haven't developed your skills in that arena, you may not notice differences where, say, a professional photographer would be like, oh my God, we completely lost the whites in this. And therefore that's going to create technical problems of how that prints and things like that. So that's the thing. Again, trust your ears, trust the people who've been there, but anybody who gets on this on a religious perspective, say, great, $5,000 versus your house. Let's do it. And that'll shut up almost everybody.
I completely agree. And while you were talking there, I invented a new catchphrase, which may be rubbish, but I'll put it out there anyway. So to sum up the maxim, be skeptical, but be respectful.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody is kind of, you're looking at them going, this is just, like you say, on a soapbox, by all means, be skeptical of that. Mm-hmm. But also have some respect for other people's experience and for the possibility that you might be missing something. Because, you know, there was, like we talked about, the example of MP3 encoding in the last episode, where I just didn't hear the problem that Nick, my colleague, did until he said, no, it's this. And suddenly there it was, and I could hear, and he was like, you're absolutely right. And I, you know, until I'd heard that, I would have fought him tooth and nail over it. So,
And I love getting proved wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no, it's much more exciting to realize that you don't know something than to think that you do.
Yep.
It's definitely. Ronan, this has been really good. I hope, last week's episode was deeply nerdy. People seem to have liked it. Nobody has complained. This one also. So I'm hoping people have enjoyed this as well. It's a fascinating and really important topic, and one that nobody should spend too much time on, because there are so many more important things to do in audio recording, mixing and mastering. So thank you for suggesting it. You want to tell people where they can find you online? I mean, they should definitely go and check out the recording show.
And even though a lot of the Ronan's recording show, I've been sort of just morphing that, a lot of that slowly into recording bootcamp. So if you go to recordingbootcamp.com, pretty easy access to my whole world. I've got several different sites, but that's the one that'll sort of get you to all of my world in terms of a lot of the free content I put out into the world and things like that.
Excellent. And you're on Facebook and Twitter as well, right?
Oh, yes. Probably too much.
Well, that doesn't happen to me. I don't spend too much time on those platforms at all. No. But for anybody who does, you can find me at Ian Shepherd on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook as well.
Yes, I'm Ronan C. Murphy on Twitter, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only Ronan Chris Murphy on Facebook.
And he's in my friends list, so you guys can find him.
And if anybody wants to learn more about drum recording, I've actually made what I think is probably the most comprehensive drum course out there. It's like 12 hours of content. And actually, if you're a fan of Ian's, if you enter the coupon code Ian at checkout, you can get a 20% discount on that.
Fantastic. That's a great offer. Yeah, people should definitely check that out. We'll put the link for that in the show notes as well. So please head over to themasteringshow.com to find the show notes for this episode and for all the other episodes. Sign up for the hot list to make sure you don't miss out on future episodes and any offers or other cool things we might be talking about there. My website is productionadvice.co.uk. This week's show was mixed and edited by John Tidy from reaperblog.net. Anybody interested in finding out more about Reaper should check that out. And the music was by Kaylee Law. Ronan, thank you so much. Everybody
else. Excellent. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening. If you've been enjoying The Mastering Show and want to improve your own mastering skills, I can help. I've made 3 online courses to do exactly that. Home Mastering EQ and Home Mastering Compression are always available whenever you'd like to try them. Find out how using compression and limiting in mastering is different and why, and unlock your own instinct for EQ. Just go to productionadvice.co.uk/resources. I also run my Home Mastering Masterclass course several times every year. It's my biggest and most popular course. I master different songs, covering different topics, and using different software every week for 8 weeks. plus giving you access to my exclusive online community and the chance to take part in monthly live streams where I answer questions and give feedback on your mixes and masters. To find out about all this and more, head over to productionadvice.co.uk/resources. You can also connect with me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Facebook, where I chat to people and share links to cool audio production resources. Come and say hello. And there's also a ton of blog posts and videos on my main website, productionadvice.co.uk, including a series of free videos I made for Sound on Sound magazine called Mastering Essentials, where I walk you through my own mastering process from start to finish with step-by-step examples. And of course, there are plenty more episodes of The Mastering Show, just like this one. Thanks for listening.